conference record has joined the conference.
All set? All set?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. Mark's gonna go back to the presentation to make this worth Dr. Thomas's time to be here. We thought we'd focus on a couple of OBGYN things make the trip worth the expense. And the other items that are in the PowerPoint for you to look at, we may circle back to them in future meetings and think about them, but because there are a number of other things we want to get to, we're not going to spend a lot of time going through each of the individual examples. Again, they are there partly for what they are, that is a specific example or an idea, but they're also just there to give get a sense of what some other folks have done, what some of the issues are around evidence related to certain benefits or procedures or services, and to stimulate conversation, which has not really been a problem. Certainly stimulate a lot of conversation. So we have about an hour and a half left. We also want to leave time to talk about next steps, to talk about processes and so on. So and also just to key up some of the additional benefits that folks have presented us with that they have interest in. So in the interest of time, more than anything else, we're going to limit this to just a couple of other slides and then have a couple of other presentations. Briefly, there's one slide about tobacco. Dr. Hannon from the SUNY School of Public Health will talk a little bit more in depth about angioplasty and PCI and some of the data from New York, Medicaid-specific, to just, again, give you a flavor and idea for an area in which there are issues around evidence and around appropriateness and around benefit. And then we'll really end talking about the process going forward and talk about the next meeting. So, Mark, do you want to?
Sure, Foster. I'll make this very quick. This is elective induction of labor less than 39 weeks completed gestation. And when we say elective induction of labor, we're talking about the induction of labor without a medical reason for doing that. And the evidence, when you look at the evidence around this, shows that there's an increased morbidity for infants of mothers that are electively induced prior to 39 weeks of gestation, including higher rates of conditions requiring them to be admitted to neonatal intensive care units. The induction of labor, particularly among women who have not had children before, and aren't really ready to deliver or have their cervix isn't ready for delivery, is associated with the increased use of healthcare resources, longer labors, increased use of cesarean delivery, and, as I mentioned before, poor neonatal outcomes. So you could consider a coverage limitation here of not allowing elective induction of labor before 39 weeks completed gestation. And some of the strategies that are being used now are what states are calling a hard stop policy, where when an induction of labor with a woman who has not completed 39 weeks gestation is requested, it's put on a stop until it can be reviewed by the head of obstetrics at the facility that where the doctor is practicing. Dr. Thomas, any corrections to what I've said?
I think they're beautiful, like the state there and 39 weeks.
I think the evidence there is irrefutable in terms of the higher costs associated with delivering prior to 39 weeks in terms of neonatal ICU and cesarean section rates. So all these things are more expensive. So I don't think there's any question that this would be a reasonable way to cover this benefit. Of course, if there's a medical reason for it, then that should be explicitly stated, and you know that can be a decision made by the medical director. So I think this is reasonable. This is also a guideline that we use as the best practice. So the days of going to the golf course, because your patient's 38 weeks, you want to get it done before you go, I think those days are over.
Can I ask a question about this?
Yeah.
Do you have any data on the prevalence of this in the Medicaid population versus population?
She asked if there is any information on the prevalence of this within Medicaid populations versus other populations?
Yes, there is. We tried to collect it before the meeting, wasn't able to do that, but folks in the public health side of the department, Kathy, have some data. I don't know how good or how reliable the fields are on the databases they use relative to payer type, but there is some information, I think, both nationally and in New York, both using vital statistics, which has issues, as well as FBFS. And right now they're doing some specific projects looking at medical records and looking at this. The biggest challenge here is about the notation of medical indication. So, you know, because it's not there in VS, does that mean it's not there? What's a reasonable medical indication? So part of this conversation is starting to shift from, okay, so we have a documentation issue. In some cases we have a practice and performance issue. But now it's so how soft and how hard or how valid are the various medical indications, and there's lots of conversation about that as well. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And also, as a practitioner at one of the largest health and hospitals at Elmhurst General, it's a hard stop rule for us practically. Also, if the residents and the doctor in charge that day tries to do anything less than 39 weeks, then, I mean, they don't even get on the schedule. So we know that from our point of view, it's a guideline that's hard and fast, and it's being practiced probably in all the other health and hospitals, corps in New York as well.
Okay, and then the final example we'll look at from this group today has to do with elective delivery of cesarean section at less than 39 weeks, and essentially the evidence is very similar for both this and induction of labor, and so the idea that, you know, to the extent that you can only limit these sort of interventions, or that you can really limit these sorts of interventions, especially to mothers that haven't completed 39 weeks of gestation, you can get better outcomes and also reduce costs, holds here as well.
Mark, thanks so much for teeing up the discussion, stimulating such great discussion. I'm going to mention this one and then go to Dr. Hannon. Just on the other side of the coin, and we may have mentioned this at the last meeting, that on the other side we have what we think of as high-value benefits, relatively low costs, cost saving over, you know, at least the medium and the long term, and in some cases, depending on which data you look at, short term as well, relative to tobacco cessation benefits. So right now, you know, we have what I would argue is a fairly generous benefit for both pharmacotherapy and counseling. As you saw in some of the letters that we received, there was some push to suggest that maybe pharmacists and dentists should be able to provide the service and bill for the service. It's a, you know, a conversation that we can take up. We have almost 500,000 smokers from our consumer assessment of health plan survey that we field every 2 years from self-report. And yet when we look at the claims data, we have the most recent year that we have is 2009. There's some more recent 2010, but it has not changed significantly. Only about 13% of smokers access the benefit. Now, clearly not 100% of smokers need to access the tobacco cessation benefit or the pharmacotherapy. But 13% is pretty low. We're able to benchmark and compare it to some other states like Massachusetts, which is closer in the 40-50% range due to a variety of differences, some in the benefit, some in advertising the benefit, and so on. We currently have an initiative to try to get 13% up to 40% over the next couple of years. And, you know, an open question for a benefit like this, which is covered, is there a benefit design issue that we need to take up. And one of the conversations we had early in prior to the first meeting was this issue of reverse copays. So we talked about copays and negative copays this morning, but you know, does it make sense to provide incentives relative to this benefit? You know, it's been kicked around as well. That's the negative, the reverse copay. I mean, I can say, because we just got the announcement today, that there was a large grant program called the Medicaid Incentive Grant Program that CMS and ARC were offering to states to provide and to research, providing incentives both for tobacco and a number of other chronic disease behaviors. And New York did get that grant, we found out today, which may give us a chance to test out some of these issues about reverse copays or incentives. But I just offer this as a, you know, from our own data around, you know, even in even when we have a benefit that seems pretty good on paper, this issue of PLMA, as you and others have been raising, and it's been raised about external validity, the way in which this benefit actually is realized is potentially problematic. So, again, the purview under the heading of what this group can or should do is make recommendations around existing benefits that might have high value, but that may need to be modified in some fashion, because we know that there is potentially underuse of the benefit. And you have the handout, I don't know if we'll have time to go through it all, on the preventive services, which tells a not too dissimilar story. A benefit that we have grade A or B evidence, but, you know, take your pick. The rates of use may be 50%, 60%, 40%, depending on the benefit. Is that a benefit design issue? Is that a behavioral medicine issue? You know, those are the things I think that we would welcome the thoughts and of the group. So I'm happy to answer any questions about this. Wasn't really meaning to spend a whole lot of time or deep dive into the benefit itself. I think we did circulate some information to you about what the actual benefit is, so that you can see, and you know, would welcome conversation about thoughts about this benefit and the way in which it's structured, and degree to which that may or may not be creating enough opportunity. But it's really meant as an example from the side of an existing benefit. Go ahead.
So the one thing that clearly stands out here is that the service has to be provided by a physician, PA, nurse practitioner, or licensed midwife. That is problematic, because they're not going to do it, or they're going to do it very fast, then as part of the visit, and really not do it as comprehensively as if there was a certified smoking cessation specialist or something. So I would think that making that change in the benefit design may increase the use of the service.
To allow who to who else?
Whoever gets certified. I know the American Lung Association certifies tobacco cessation specialists, smoking cessation specialists, whatever the standard is for those people. And I do have to say, I know that you reimburse for certified asthma educators, but the truth is you probably look at your data, and that's probably very low, because nobody except the physician will pass that exam. So sometimes the criteria that you set for providing the service, who could provide it, is just not realistic.
I just want to say that the city of New York actually put in a proposal on the dentists and the pharmacists, and I thought that made a lot of sense. I mean, I don't know if we're dwelling on it, but the other thing I wanted, kudos to that. But the other thing that I wanted to say is it just seemed really interesting to me that the tiny 3,000 member plan, I guess, is able to have like a 27% rate, or 61% rate. If I could, the 61% of patients receiving. And I just wonder if there's a way to talk to some of these big boy plans. And Blum, I guess you're in the room. You know, you're in the house. I don't know which number you are, but I'm sure you're one of these larger plans that have a relatively lower rate. And I wonder if there's, you know, talking to the Health First and the Emblems and the Metro Plus, at least in the city, you might be more, it might be more effective having some heart-to-hearts with the medical directors in those programs. I mean, I think if the state's really serious about this.
Yeah, the numbers on there are the numbers of smokers, not the numbers of enrollees. When we look at, you know, who's doing better or worse or so on, I think
we do so well, we're the 3,000.
Because you only have 3,000 smokers in HIP? I don't think so. City workers. You just shop that line elsewhere.
As I recall, there was one plan that was very much, you know, that was very high, and it was, you know, very interesting. And but most of the plans are kind of in the same range, and the range is low. So we've not, you know, again, we take different tacks of, you know, when we have real wide variation, You know, we take the approach of let's find out what the folks at the higher range are doing. When we have not much variation, the performance is low, it's, you know, what are we doing and what do we need to do together? So there is right now a very an active collaboration among plans that includes, as you say, the big boys and girls, as well as the medium size, as well as the American Cancer Society, as well as the Office of Mental Health and the Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse and the City Health Department to talk about messaging, benefit, with pharmacy benefit going to the plans. This becomes a new issue as well. As of right now, these benefits are, you know, at least the pharmacotherapy ones are carved out. So how will that change, or will that change, or can that get better with it being within the plan? So there is an effort.
Yeah, well, in that way, I think the city's proposal to have pharmacists reimbursed for counseling around it makes a lot of sense because it's sort of point of service, right? So.
Well, I guess the question would be, and, you know, and again, we'll get into this when we start thinking about evaluating proposals, is what's the evidence that they'll do it? I mean, Paloma, you know, I don't know if it works in your mouth, but you might say those are also the wrong folks. I mean, sure, we include them, but are those the groups that are really most likely to be doing counseling? Don't know. Maybe so. So, and there are issues about who we can allow to bill Medicaid, or at least there's policy decisions, and there's the State Education Department that weighs in on issues about scope of practice and so on. That has, you know, an example of our asthma educators and our diabetes educators has weighed in terms of who can perform what services and so on. So there are some issues and some constraints. You know, again, we have to work within them or poke around and try to expand them.
It seems that even looking at some of the evidence-based stuff, it's there. Yet how does that really play out in a population? So the standards are there, the doctor practices the standards, the patient is not compliant. And the missing gap is care coordination. And I'm not sure that health homes will capture that, all of that. Like in the case of kids in following asthma guidelines, they may not rise to the level of a health home criteria. But I think there has to be some figuring out of how that care coordination is paid for by Medicaid, because I think that's really the missing link in a lot of these things that we see. And in among them, you could include things like smoking cessation counseling and health promotion.
I think one of the things this raises is the question of scope of practice, which I think is an extremely complicated subject. It's probably, I don't know if it's really worth it to go in an ad hoc method to talk about each benefit and the scope of practice for it, but I think would be valuable to the state is to consider in terms of the overall process through which benefits are going to be handled in the future to set up a process inside of that to define scope of practice issues. Otherwise, you're going to be working on a one-to-one basis on scope of practice for every single thing, particularly on preventive services, at a time where, you know, healthcare reform and the delivery side is going to change significantly.
Well, they bump into each other.
No, I just talked about scope of practice for designing a benefit. So you have to basically, it's these issues of who can bill, who does it, who's authorized to do it. That's a really complicated subject. There's been a lot of thinking on it. It's a huge national issue that we can tap into because these issues sort of are playing out with health reform. So I think that is probably something that needs an explicit process for the benefit design as a whole.
Let me just add just 2 seconds on this, that there's a lot of very good data that suggests that dentists can have a meaningful effect. It really can be effective in terms of smoking cessation, as effective as any of these programs can be. And that data has been published and will be made available. The issue here for us is exactly the same thing, and that's scope of practice. And what the Education Department allows, and everyone keeps pointing, Education points to Department of Health points to Education.
Right. So, I mean,
we have another MRT subcommittee on workforce, and a lot of their time is going to be spent on scope of practice. Doesn't mean we shouldn't address it, but it should probably be a more broader approach from us.
Great, that's helpful. Is that work group going on right now, Dr. Shaw?
It's starting. The invitations have gone out.
workforce is going in. Okay. So it's being, so there's a sort of general process looking at it, but you're absolutely right. Every single benefit design and a feature of benefit design that have to grapple with is this issue of who delivers the benefit, who can or cannot deliver the benefit, and that has, you know, something to do, as do a number of other factors, with what actually happens in the real world about how the benefit is delivered. Two things about part of education. I mean, the experience that we've had working with them relative to asthma educators and diabetes educators that's most recent to me is absolutely their scope of practice issues. I think it's been a policy of Medicaid to not reimburse clinicians for things that the Department of Education says is not within their scope. Now, you know, what's in their scope and how they make those decisions, you know, in the new world of new job titles and new kinds of functions and new ways of thinking about folks and performing at the top of her title, I'm not even talking about all the controversy about what nurse practitioners should do and so on, it can be challenging. But ultimately, it is, in fact, a policy decision on our part to say whether we want to reimburse practitioners who may be operating out of their scope of practice per Department of Education. Right?
Correct, and we've just historically taken the position that we would not pay for something that was by state's lawyer's definition out of that scope and therefore illegally delivered. So we, you know, there's room to think about that. There's room to talk to the education department. We've had some success with having discussions at the margins, for instance, on what LPNs can do and cannot do, what nurses can do and cannot do. But some of those are backed up with state law. So we have to respect that. Respect it or change it.
Right. Anything else before we move on to yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say what many of you heard me say in other venues, and that is we really need to look at, as opposed to expanding practice, which is not necessarily a bad idea, but what is wrong and what is weak in what we're doing now and where are the missed opportunities. I mean, I look at, obviously, the youngest population, so I look at moments of teachable moments with OBGYNs and pregnant women. How much work is really being done about smoking cessation in that interface, and how is the state incentivizing those interfaces in terms of money and time that can be spent? The same thing for well-child visits when a new mom brings baby in to talk. We, you know, we always talk about you shouldn't smoke, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, but how much time is it? And we have a lot of issues around who's patient, is it? You know, can we write the script right there to get what the parent says? Yeah, I want to stop smoking. I have a new baby in the house. I really want to do it. Or I want to get my husband to stop smoking. Can I bring him in? These are like teachable moments that I think are not incentivized in the current process. And I think we need to look at those moments and also look at school-based healthcare for adolescent smoking cessation, which I think is really important with peer educators, the way we do with reproductive health care. I just think there are a lot of places that we're just sort of not looking, where we could incentivize the process now without fighting with the Department of Education, which might be a long-term goal, but it's not going to change things for people tomorrow, which this could, if we looked at this differently, could change things for tomorrow.
So it's a great discussion. I think it raises the issue that benefit design isn't the end-all be-all for some of these issues. I mean, I think what we're trying to do is to figure out how we can, in benefit design, do as much as benefit design can do to move things in the right direction, but there are a whole host of issues like fixing the whole delivery system that are not going to be fixed by benefit design, although you might argue, maybe, Plumley, you would suggest that, you know, coverage of care coordinators might go some way to fixing what's broken in the system. But, I mean, suffice to say there are other levers and other problems that need to be addressed, and there's another work group dealing with payment and quality, for example, that... And you heard the workforce one, and one on behavioral health, and so on. So, you know, there isn't a presumption, at least on our part, and we should be clear that having the perfect benefit design necessarily solves all these issues. There's other work to be done. Kate, did you have something on this?
This conversation got me thinking about, there are benefits out there that aren't being maybe used as much as we'd like to see them used, and maybe it's, sometimes it's scope of practice issues, sometimes it's payment issues. And I think one of the other levers that's out there is what are the what are the QAR data? So what are the data that we expect now that everybody's theoretically going to be sometime soon all in managed care? What are the data that we expect those managed care organizations to share with us so that we can evaluate their performance? So I think there's that piece of it too.
And the QAR piece, which is for those of you that aren't steeped in it, is like HEDIS measures, process measures of effectiveness of care, technical quality, is in that grid around preventive services that I mentioned. And to the degree that we have rates that relate to that specific preventive service, we have a measure on it. It's a measure not of the entire Medicaid program, but of those that are in Medicaid managed care, which is to date has been the measurable part of our program. So it's another way of looking at to what degree does benefit being delivered, and whether it's a benefit design or other issues around why that rate is 30, 40, 50%, is up for conversation. I guess on one hand, Henry.
Austin, just really a data question, but it's just a disconnect here. You know, on the one hand, you have the CAHPS survey reporting that roughly 50% of patients have discussed medication, have discussed strategies. Then, of course, on the claim side, it's abysmal. It's not reflected. So how do you reconcile, that data?
I think discussed strategies isn't the same as actually going and picking up a script or getting counseling. So those strategies can be a variety of things, some of which require use of the benefit and some which don't. But I think that, there's a voltage gap between conversations that happen in clinical practice and what happens afterwards, or, whether somebody gets prescribed something or whether somebody picks it up or whether somebody, has that specific bills for that specific counseling. There may be folks who are doing that counseling in the way that you described that don't bother to bill for it for a variety of reasons. So I think, we know that that number probably shouldn't be 100%, but also know that 13% seems kind of low. So, again, I may feel like we're all over the place, but, trying to tee up some examples with the data that we actually have about certain benefits to kind of give you a flavor for what some of the issues are, what some of the problems, what some of the opportunities are. This sort of moving to potentially one related to overuse, or it gets into at least appropriate use of cardiac interventions, which Dr. Hannon has, devoted more than a couple of months of his career to thinking about, publishing about, and doing research on. So just going to turn things over to Dr. Hannon.
Thanks very much, Dr. Gustin. My name is Ed Hannon. I'm a distinguished professor emeritus at the University at Albany School of Public Health. For more than 20 years now, we at the school have been maintaining the cardiac registries and cardiac surgery and angioplasty for the New York State Department of Health, publishing reports that assess risk-adjusted mortality for hospitals and physicians. And in recent years, we've been doing a lot of stuff on comparative effectiveness analysis, comparing outcomes for bypass surgery and angioplasty, different kinds of stents, different kinds of cardiac surgery, et cetera. And what I want to do is talk about some of the data that we have applied to some national standards that have been developed. The beginning here is probably well known to you, so I'll kind of go over this very quickly. Heart disease is the number one killer. Coronary heart disease, the most common type of heart disease that involves narrowing of the coronary arteries. This can lead to angina, chest pain, and can lead to death when a patient suffers a myocardial infarction or a heart attack. The treatments for coronary heart disease, three of them, medical therapy, PCI, which is used to be called coronary angioplasty, it's now called percutaneous coronary intervention, or PCI, and coronary artery bypass graft surgery. Generally, the options for patients with milder heart disease are medical therapy versus PCI. Mild meaning one or two vessels, coronary vessels, sufficiently narrowed to more than 70%. And for severe heart disease, which would be two or three vessels with also left main disease, options would be PCI versus CABG surgery. Patients who get the PCI and CABG surgery generally get medical therapy too. So we're really talking about medical therapy versus medical therapy and PCI versus medical therapy versus and CABG surgery as the options. The PCI is the one I want to talk about the most. This involves threading a catheter through up to the coronary arteries, generally through the groin area, inflating a balloon to widen the narrowed artery, and then inserting a stent to hold the plaque against the artery wall. There have been a lot that has changed over the years in terms of angioplasty. Initially, it was just balloon angioplasty. There were no stents. Then there were just bare metal stents, and now there are drug-eluting stents whereby drugs are emitted from the stent. It's very well known for treating evolving heart attacks. It's the definitive treatment because what it does is it breaks up the clot in the artery by inserting the catheter through there and blowing up the balloon, restoring flow blood flow to the heart. It's not as well known as the definitive treatment for patients who have milder heart disease, and that's what this is all about. There have been many things that have been done by the national societies regarding guidelines and regarding appropriateness criteria for PCI and for CABG and for medical therapy. A few years ago, there were a set of guidelines that were developed, but most recently what they came out with was a set of appropriateness criteria. What the appropriateness criteria do, first and foremost, is to determine whether revascularization, meaning PCI or CABG surgery, one or the other, is appropriate vis-a-vis medical therapy, and then secondly, whether for patients for whom revascularization is appropriate, whether PCI is a better option than CABG surgery. As it turns out, looking at our database, the second part really doesn't work very well at all because they took just a subset of patients that they found appropriate for revascularization to draw opinions on of PCI versus CABG surgery, and there just aren't enough patients there. So the real heart of the findings is to determine for patients who receive PCI and CABG surgery whether it's appropriate or not. The methods that are used to determine appropriateness go back to the RAND criteria that were developed back in the 1970s and 80s, whereby there is a group of experts who sits around a table and comes up with judgments based on access to all of the data that are available at that time. So they look at all of the clinical trials, they look at all the observational studies, they have access to all that information, and then they have a process whereby they eventually reach consensus. And consensus means one of three things. Either it's appropriate, PCI or CABG is appropriate, it's uncertain, meaning the evidence doesn't really point in one direction or the other, or it's clearly inappropriate. What we did was to use the New York State Registry data to take these ACC, AHA appropriateness criteria and try to determine among patients who had cardiac surgery, CABG surgery, or PCI, just how many of those patients were inappropriate, appropriate, and uncertain for these procedures. We don't have data, for the most part, on patients who received medical treatment, so we're looking in one direction. We're looking at overuse of these invasive procedures. First of all, we found that for CABG surgery, it was appropriate 90% of the time. There really didn't seem to be any problem when you're comparing CABG surgery against medical therapy. When patients had CABG surgery, it seemed pretty appropriate. That is a little bit easier because, again, the CABG surgery is on patients with severe heart disease, three vessels disease, or left main disease. It's rare that medical therapy is used solely on those patients. However, we found another thing when we took a look at PCI. When we looked at the Medicaid patients between July 2009 and December 2010, there were around 3,800 patients who could be rated. Some patients didn't have sufficient information to be rated. Of those, 103,000 could be rated. 37% were appropriate, 51% were uncertain, and 12% were inappropriate. So 63% of these patients were either inappropriate completely or uncertain, meaning there's no way of telling whether PCI was better than medical therapy, keeping in mind that PCI is far more expensive than medical therapy because the patients who are getting PCI are essentially getting the same kind of medical therapy as the medical therapy-only patients. To try to cost out the impact of these options. we looked at three different scenarios. One, just being as conservative as possible and assuming that all the inappropriate cases were either eliminated or not reimbursed for, even though the patients had PCI. Two, looking at patients who were inappropriate and at all cases without accurate documentation of disease. And three, all inappropriate, all uncertain, and all inadequate documentation. It may seem a bit much for us in numbers two and three to be taking a look at or to be considering eliminating or not reimbursing for patients without adequate documentation. But what that really means in this context is that we called all of the hospitals and asked them if they did not have accurate documentation in the registries regarding the information that was needed to determine appropriateness, whether or not that was just a matter of them not reporting it to us or having it somewhere else that they couldn't find, or whether they truly didn't know that information before determining PCI. And invariably, we were told that they truly didn't know the information because things like stress tests were done in physicians' offices and they hadn't gathered the information, weren't told the information about the results of those tests. So when we do apply in each of those three scenarios, one question here is, what is the cost of PCI? The national cost that has been quoted is $20,000. We thought that may be a bit high. We were unable to come up with the exact cost yet for Medicaid patients. The $20,000 may be a bit high because it includes the emergency patients who are getting PCI for a heart attack. Also, the reimbursement for Medicaid is not as generous as it is for all patients. So what we did is to take a very conservative $5,000 figure also, and then to take a look at these scenarios. So these are potential annual savings from each of these three scenarios, which you can see range from $1 million annually to $37 million. Okay, that's kind of a quick introduction to this. I'd be happy to flesh this out a lot more if you have any questions about it. Question?
I guess I just wonder about the law of unintended consequences. So if the state adopted one of your scenarios and the result was is that the hospital sort of redid all the testing that was done in a doctor's office, it seems to me that we would end up generating potentially additional costs. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Well, it's not a matter of redoing the testing that was done in a doctor's office. It's a matter of getting the results of the test.
You would think, but I bet if a hospital, it's going to be a lot easier just to redo the test. I mean, you would think that's what they would do. But I think we know in reality what happens is we have an enormous amount of duplication of testing that happens to, or at least the clients we serve on our hotline. We do the state ombuds program, and we get, you know, clients that are sent from doctor's office to doctor's office where they redo all the radiology, they redo all the, you know, everything. And that's a commercial context, you know, so it's sort of...
Well, I mean, that calls into question whether or not redoing the test should be paid for. You know, if you decide to redo the test rather than gather the information, then the question is, well, should that be...
My point is that there's a lot of externalities when you move any policy lever that we should be thinking about. So, because there are all these unintended consequences.
Yeah, I mean, I should give a few caveats on this. I mean, one of the things is that in the appropriateness criteria, they do state that there are exceptions to the rule. So sometimes even though these are the criteria that denote inappropriateness, there can be exceptions to the rule, and so... Ideally, there would be some way to accommodate exceptions to the rule. However, it's certainly not the case that these exceptions to the rule account for these enormous expenditures that seem to be inappropriate, because if there were exceptions to the rule that were spread across the board, you would find the same amount of inappropriateness across hospitals, and the rate of inappropriateness across hospitals ranged from 1 to 40%. With a mean of 13%.
So I think this is a really strong model for us to consider for many different dimensions. So appropriateness was first used sort of in a very sophisticated way to look at cardiovascular revascularization, particularly for CABGs in California. And the criteria that we discussed, the RAND appropriateness criteria, I think would be a very interesting model for people to follow. I think it's been very well developed. It's been rigorously studied, evaluated, developed, And I think in terms of a process to make benefit recommendations would be a good one to follow. It utilizes a modified Delphi method, which is something originally developed at Rand in the 1950s to facilitate decision-making, particularly related to game theory, things such as that. But it's a way of making explicit policy decision-making. That's really sort of what guides this kind of process. And I think one of the things we've seen with this as part of what makes it interesting is that initially when people did the work, they found a lot of cabbages were highly inappropriately done, both in the United States and internationally. And sort of with the innovation involved with angioplasty, the new technology sort of displaced the old one, and a different set of practice mixtures developed, which is what we're seeing now. So it's a good example of how appropriateness needs to be a process that's followed over time longitudinally, and you evaluate different kinds of innovations iteratively. And this is something where evidence is a key part of doing that, but it involves sort of an entire process where it's like, what are you going to do, who's going to do it, how's it going to be governed, things like that.
Yeah, I think the key that perhaps I didn't emphasize enough is that the kind of data that are necessary in order to determine appropriateness in this particular case are the number of vessels, the number of coronary vessels diseased, where disease means greater than or equal to 70% stenosis, narrowing of the artery, whether or not there's left anterior descending involvement, proximal left anterior descending involvement, which is a certain area of one of the arteries close to the left main that feeds into the three coronary arteries, the degree of the angina, the amount of chest pain the patient has, determined by how much exercise it requires in order to trigger the angina, the results of the medical therapy, whether or not the patient is on intensive medical therapy or not, because that's an option, and also the results of the stress test. And a lot of that information is available only in the cardiac registries, not available in the Medicaid data per se.
And I think that raises another issue. New York State's been a leader in the utilization of information technology. So one of the ways that sort of to put all this together, it would be interesting to try to coordinate efforts between what, you know, we'd want to do in benefits with what people are doing in information exchange, the implementation of electronic health records, to sort of make sure that the data that's required to do this kind of evaluation and make these decisions is captured in formats that can be utilized easily.
In terms of your analysis, did you or did you not eliminate the emergency procedures?
Yes. This particular savings is related to patients with stable coronary artery disease. Again, with the emergency procedures, for the most part, PCI is very appropriate.
That's an excellent point. You know, your approach here about appropriateness criteria reminds me of, you know, what we do right now with regards to prior authorization of advanced imaging for things like low back pain, shoulder pain, and things like that, where, you know, for the most part, what we're trying to do is really educate our providers about what constitutes adequate documentation. And over time, I think, you know, what we have found is that providers become very good at getting the right kinds of documentation. In fact, some of them have said it actually makes them better clinicians because they're getting the feedback from a fellow physician who's working with them collegially along the lines of low back pain. So I think using appropriateness criteria, integrating into prior auth, is a very, very valuable thing. The other thing that we hear about quite a bit around elective type issues, whether it's this or advanced imaging, is that the patients are often very demanding and they want the procedure because they've heard from such and such doctors, they have no doctors or they know healthcare professionals who recommend these things to them. And oddly enough, what we've heard from our physicians in Montefiore is that they actually know that they're sending inappropriate requests for advanced imaging and other kinds of things to us in the hopes that we will deny it so that they can then go to their patient and say, see, I told you that, you know, what you were asking for is going to be inappropriate. So,
well, there's two facets to the patients demanding it. One of them is that the only reason that the patients would be in a position to want to demand it is that they have been educated to think that it's the best thing for them incorrectly. The second one is that when they decide that they want to have that and they tell the cardiologist that they do, there's a distinction between whether the patient has severe coronary artery disease or mild. In the case of the severe coronary artery disease, the two options are angioplasty and CABG surgery. CABG surgery is a very, very invasive procedure that's going to lay you up for a year. You're not going to feel yourself for a long time. You're going to be in the hospital for a while. You're going to be out of work for a while and everything else. It's obvious that the patient is hearing what those two procedures involve is going to prefer angioplasty. But in this situation, we're talking about the other end of the spectrum, patients with mild coronary artery disease, where the option is medical therapy. And so the options are you have medical therapy or you have the same medical therapy and you have a semi-invasive procedure. So why the patient should prefer the second option there is not clear.
Just to full disclosure, I am a cardiologist. I do not do procedures, and I'm not here representing anything having to do with cardiology. But I do want to underscore a point that Ed made and maybe add a little bit of clarity to the discussion. I see some of these patients who wind up going for these procedures, hopefully only the ones that are appropriate. You know, the key issue in whether an angioplasty is indicated or not is really what you said before, and that is, whether the lesional diameter is sufficient enough to significantly narrow the coronary artery. There's actually debate within, you know, the cardiology community as to whether that's angiographically determined, meaning shoot the dye and look at the x-rays, or whether ultrasonographically is actually a better way to do it, both in reducing false positives and false negatives. So that's number one. But I think, as you said, that's really the key issue. I'm a little less excited about the issue of is there a stress test or is there not, for some of the reasons that Elizabeth said before, but maybe with a little bit of variation. Sometimes based on a clinical story, and particularly given the fact that stress testing is nowhere near 100%, either sensitive or specific, and, you know, the clinicians in the room can, I'm sure, agree with that, there are situations where it's actually more efficient and cheaper to simply go right to cath if you have suspicion that, you know, you're not going to really accept the negative result as, you know, as being conclusive enough. You know, Bayes' theorem very much comes into play in this regard. So I would just, you know, agree with what you said, certainly not dispute the conclusions, but I also think that, you know, it's a little more complicated than simply was there a stress test in the chart or was there not, and I just wanted to make that point.
Well, let me respond to that. With regard to the stress test, I presented this very quickly, so I brushed over some of the details. One of the details is that the stress tests are not always required in order to make a determination of appropriateness. There are many instances in which the stress test is missing, but it's not needed, depending upon the cell that the patient falls in. And most part, for the most part, the kinds of patients for whom the stress test is needed is patients who look so undiseased in every other way that the stress test is needed in order to convince someone that there's reason to go forward. So these are patients who are asymptomatic. They don't have angina, et cetera, et cetera. And those are the only ones where the stress test is needed. So what we're saying is in those cases, that stress test information is critical. And then I say we're saying what the ACC/AHA says.
Yeah, I agree completely.
I was just going to comment as a practicing physician in my community, very often a patient will come in and they know a lot of people that have had these procedures done. And they simply say, you know, medical management, Aunt Myrtle died with, you know, having medical management. Therefore, I want this done, and this is my right, and I need to have this done. And then it's a large uphill battle to educate them. And when you can actually educate a person as to what and why and how and what the risks are, sometimes they'll back off. But more times than not, they don't want to back off. They want a quick now fix, and then they'll take medicines maybe afterwards. But in more likelihood, they're not going to change their lifestyle in the next 6 months. They're back to doing what they had done previously and say, you know, I had it done once. I can certainly enjoy having it done a second time. And that's an uphill battle we have to figure out how to deal with.
Yeah, well, I mean, it gets back to what it was in the first place that gave me the idea that this was going to work. I mean, what the evidence is saying is that it is not working any better than the medical therapy. And so what evidence do they have? If the evidence they have is that three of their friends had it and it worked and they no longer and they had angina relief, that's one thing. If it's that they were convinced in by this by talking to other clinicians, that's another story.
Well, isn't that true of most things though? Even with evidence-based medicine, most physicians don't follow it anyway, because whether it's university-based or not, we're getting better at this. But we tend to get lots of evidence out there and go, well, our experiential knowledge is so much better than the evidence. We're going to do it this way anyway. And that gets back to community standards and things like that. So I think this has got to be, you know, in terms of this type of discussion, it's more of a sea change of how we practice medicine as opposed to what we actually say in these rooms.
Well, that's certainly true, and it gets back to all of the things we're talking about, but that's what we're talking about is how do we go about doing that and becoming effective at it.
That's great. So I think the benefit design is really to think about how benefits can be the intelligent bad guy to help you in those discussions or to do as Henry described. I mean, that is partly, benefit design is going to necessarily change human behavior, but whether something is or in fact is covered or is not covered, or whether you get a yes or a no, whether there's a process that you have to go through at your institution, you know, you have to convince the head of OBGYN that there's some reason why you're doing this, even though it looks like there's no middle, I mean, something, you know, people with speed bumps, you know, whatever it is, that's, I think, part of the point and part of what we're aiming at in terms of thinking about our benefit design.
So,
and to how to do that well in a way that is mindful of the evidence and that's mindful of folks' sensibilities is the challenge. Right?
So, Foster, in that respect, as we're moving through this, we have areas where people want to have benefit increases. What's the low-hanging fruit out there that we go after to start to look at how to redesign this? How do we get to that low-hanging fruit?
The place psychiatrist again. That's what we're hoping that you guys will help us identify. So we presented, I mean, there are some examples in Mark's presentation, not all of which we went through. In my experience, there's no such thing as a low-hanging fruit when it comes to stopping covering something. It's all really high up there because, you know, one person's waste is another person's, you know, tuition payment. So there are issues around, you know, around this, but that's exactly what we're looking for, Gene, is to try to identify other things that we know, either in our own data or nationally or around the hunches or the clinical experience of this group or others, you know, what's a reasonable place to start and to target. And, you know, again, the goal of this group is to really identify some opportunities on both sides, in the next month or two to put forth the specific recommendations to the Medicaid redesign team. And, again, the more specific, I think, the more helpful. But it may be that this group ends up we don't know yet what the level of specificity this group will be able to do relative to those recommendations in the next month and a half. That answer?
Sure.
So, Foster, isn't there a way of you guys gathering data that kind of identifies what are those really, really big expenses that look wacky and being able to then focus in on them versus the entire benefit package?
Yes and no. So, yes, there's a way to gather information about where expenses are high and where expenses are increasing. There's a way to look across the literature and look across what other states and other payers are looking at in terms of technology and services around which there's an uncertain benefit or controversy about benefits. So those are reasonable places to begin, and hopefully there's some crosswalk between the two, not always. And then, you know, the last is to look for opportunity. That is, are there areas in which we're already doing something in this area that we don't really need to think about doing it? So I think part of our work between this meeting and the next is to really, you know, come up with a grid or a matrix that helps us think about what are the important characteristics that would help us define what's, as you say, low-hanging fruit on either side, on the benefit addition or on the benefit subtraction or limitation. What are the features that would make it desirable to do that and to kind of think about what the nomenclature would be around that.
And I would just add to that that as we're sort of thinking about how we use the
meeting of this group. That question may be the right frame for getting us to our final work product. And I think Foster's suggesting some kind of a grid. We've laid out some suggestions in the PowerPoint. We have people around this table that do benefit design work for a living that could, you know, potentially feed to us. And we've got our own laundry list of things that we've been collecting, a list of, and I'll just, you know, grossly refer to them as adds and subtracts, that we could take up potentially as a committee to look at in balance as a set of potential recommendations for the final work product. And if folks were amenable between this meeting and the next meeting, we could begin to collect those various ideas. We've candidly received more adds than we have subtract between the first meeting and this meeting. And I think with our sort of cost neutrality mandate here, we have to, you know, think about, you know, balancing. We've now, you know, purposely added some ideas about, you know, benefit review through the lens of specific services. So we could lay those out in a grid, ship them around between meetings, get people, you know, thinking about, we could, you know, try to lay in people and dollars to the extent that that's possible. And then maybe use that as a discussion point for the third meeting if the group thought that that was helpful.
I guess what I'm suggesting is having the data drive our work so that if we could even figure out what the models for cesarean, elective cesarean sections are across the country or whatever exists, whatever data exists, and then compare New York State's performance against those, then it gives us areas to kind of focus in on where the low-hanging fruit may be and the high cost may also be.
The no part of my answer was that having the kind of data that you really need to look at appropriate use, which is really what you want to look at, is limited to certain conditions that we have the ability to look at. So we can give counted amounts on lots of different things, but doesn't necessarily answer the question about whether it's being delivered, you know, according to appropriateness criteria, whether people are getting well, you know. So the challenge is what information we have and what information we don't have. But I think that, you know, what we try to tee up with a little bit more detail for the next, between now and the next meeting, is a set of some information about specifics. Again, as Greg said, on the plus and the minus side, to sort of look at, and that might help stimulate what's the information you really want to know about those particular benefits and how to use. But in my experience, sometimes looking at sort of the numbers or the amounts or even the rates, you know, they raise more questions than they answer. But that's not to say we shouldn't look at data or look at dollars or look at whatever information we have. Joe and then Elliot.
Yeah, this is sort of related to benefits, but maybe slightly off, but there's many situations that I run into where I have to send kids out of state for procedures that no one does in New York State. And what I end up doing is paying more than what the Blue Cross people pay for it because I'm Medicaid, they don't recognize it. Is there any opportunity for New York to come into mutual agreements with various states like Pennsylvania or Ohio or whatever? Like, for example, I have to send some kids to Cincinnati Children's Hospital to get certain cardiac procedures that nobody does here in New York City. And that's a lot of money because it does get back to the state's budget because that's in the medical expense bucket. It goes up, and then, you know, you set your rates off of that. Are there any opportunities that the state could be looking at that? Because it's one thing that I could be a mutual thing where people from other states can send their folks to New York City, which they wouldn't do right now for various reasons and whatever. So
I'm trying to figure out whether it's in scope or not. I mean, I understand the issue. I have to think about it a little bit to know. But I mean, it could. I guess in some way that could take the form of a specific suggestion about a benefit. But I would say the issue of saving money by, you know, either having agreements between states for specialty centers and so on, which has been a big topic of conversation among state Medicaid medical directors in the group that I belong with. Without any specific conclusion because of a lot of challenges of doing that, but all of us who do the state at the plan level struggling with that, relates to the issue of saving money. I don't know if it relates
strictly speaking to the scope of the group. What do you think?
My instinct is collect it, stare at it, work on it, but it may not be centerlined to the committee. But I think it's a valid point. We have the same issue in fee-for-service. As you know,
right.
We negotiate those same rates, very often held hostage to those institutions that are the minority providing those specialty procedures. It isn't an easy fix that's within the scope of a benefit conversation, but nevertheless, it's probably meritorious of talking about it a little bit more.
Right.
Admittedly, utilization and rate information across other states wouldn't be definitive, but I also maybe naively thought that it would at least provide a first-level screen and maybe, you know, the ability to, you know, hit some areas that have a high likelihood of being fruitful. So I just wanted to, you know, sort of support the point.
So what do you imagine being, just play out for me, what do you imagine the information would be? Like, what are the things you'd want to see that would be helpful to you?
I'll throw something out, and I'm making this up, and maybe it's different. But, you know, for example, if we looked at rates of, induced deliveries or C-sections in, you know, women under 39 weeks and found that, you know, the rate here was, you know, double the average across the country or something a little more subtle like cath rates, you know, a lot of your early work was in that regard. You know, cath rates seem to be, you know, double the number for covered lives compared with a whole bunch of other places. It certainly wouldn't be definitive, but to me it would say, gee, we ought to go look there.
Cut by Medicaid?
Pardon me?
Sliced by Medicaid?
Yeah. In other words, I'm assuming there's data, you know, comparing Medicaid programs across the country. I mean the whole notion that...
Big assumption. So there's limited data
there isn't, but...
So I think, yeah. Right.
I mean, the whole notion of New York spending, you know, more per member...
twice as much as the next state. Is that enough information to know?
Well, that's all we got is what you're saying.
No, we have a little bit more than that about where New York differs in terms of its spending on Medicaid compared to other states or the nation. I mean, that information, Peter Leff, the United Hospital Fund and others have done a lot of publishing about that and about the why that is, what's good about it, what's bad about it, and so on. And there are some things in which we can show and look at, you know, are we an outlier relative to C-sections and so on. And I think the answer to that is we're not an outlier. For many of the statistics, we end up, for a variety of reasons, some of the statistical being in the middle of the pack. One thing we know we're on the edge of as an outlier is avoidable hospitalizations, cut by Medicaid or cut by commercial or cut by Medicare. But we're going to...
Yeah, I was just going to say that, they're comparing specific procedures within procedures with the right denominator is hard to get to comparing to another state. But we can produce counts and amounts, which sometimes are helpful. You know, one thing that is easy for all of us to forget in Medicaid is that, the feds are picking up most of the procedures for the duals. So our expenditure on procedures, even like some of those that we've been talking about, in the straight-line Medicaid population is not astronomical. We spend more on medicine than we do on surgeries. We spend more on psychiatry, mental health, addictions than we do on a lot of evidence-based and non-evidence-based medical practice.
Well, that was you've actually fed into my next question, which is I understand at the disease or procedure or condition level how the discussion's going and what you... hopefully to have some discussion about. But, and maybe it was covered during the first phone call and I missed it, but at a higher level, you know, the almost policy level, things like do we cover addiction services or do we cover transportation or other things, is that part of the scope of this deliberation as well or does that go someplace else?
I think primarily the behavioral health is in the scope of another group and they are working on that. Certainly questions can, you know, be coming out of this group because we're talking about base benefit. But my only point was that if we did catalog a set of options for the pluses and minuses, we can do our best to attach what we have in dollars. I think Foster's point is that
comparatives is, it becomes difficult, particularly drilled in comparatives. But we, a small spend is a small spend. A large spend may not be large savings, but we know a small spend isn't going to be big savings.
So as we're talking, I think part of what's coming to my mind is on this imaginary grid is certain information that would be helpful to deciding whether something is in fact low-hanging fruit or worth talking about. And one of them would be, is there evidence that, you know, New York is an outlier on this or not? Are large expenses connected to it? And drill down beyond our large expenses, within those expenses, do we think that there's avoidable costs based on appropriateness, based on data that are done, you know? You know, how good is that evidence? I mean, there's a number of things, and for some of these we might have some numbers or some, you know, put in that box, and for some things we might not. But I think what you're getting at is what we're struggling with as well, which is among all the things on the pluses and the minuses, how do we prioritize and use data, as data-driven as we possibly can be, to identify the areas that have the biggest opportunity? I mean, I get that as the sort of the ask, and I can say is that we're struggling with that along with you because we've never really taken this kind of view of benefit, and benefit conversations have mostly been, you know, historically in the here's what you have to cover, there are legislative decisions, or there's political decisions, or there's advocacy decisions, or it's the cut or the addition of the month or the year based on whatever. So we're really, to some degree, this is a new territory to think about the benefit in this fashion.
If we want to, just a comment on that, if that's the direction that we want to head in or go in, I think that's the kind of thing that should be reflected in the principles and currently isn't. So if we have, for instance, like the principle of equity, what we're really sort of discussing now are a whole set of different kind of principles upon which a prioritization process would be done. So one principle I think you can clearly discern from the beginning is the notion of equity. The second thing was having it being evidence-driven. Now, if we're going to start doing things like using a data-driven approach to identify quote-unquote low-hanging fruit, which is really a low proportion of patients accounting for a high proportion of the spend, then that involves a very different set of principles. And that would give whatever group ultimately approves the benefits in the process an entirely different set of principles. It's really those principles that should drive the prioritization process and the method as well.
So I agree. So we're going to need really two ways and just to two things. One is a quick and dirty way of prioritizing for this group to reach an endpoint of within a month and a half or so having recommendations, and then recommendations about a prioritization process, whether it's principles or other ways of framing what we mean by that for the process going forward for Medicaid. And we need to sort of do both, and one may reflect the other or have some relationship to the other, but I would just submit that there's a quicker one that we're going to need to do to try to sort through recommendations if we want to, as an output of this group, have specific recommendations and decide among the 20,000 possibilities of things to add and 20,000 things to subtract.
Right. I was just going to add on that Dr. Chowdhury's point that it may be something that isn't low utilization, high cost, and maybe something that's very high utilization, very low cost. And so you have to crosswalk the other way because it may not be appropriate, but it may not cost much on a per-click basis, but we do an awful lot of it. So those are areas we have to also pay attention to at both ends of that spectrum.
And then there's a...
Scott.
Okay. I think both can be consistent. So in other words, there are principles that we'll all agree upon, and then there might be a more quick and dirty algorithm. But I think that algorithm can be contained within the principles if we design it correctly. You know, and so I don't think there needs to be an inconsistency there.
But isn't there also another overlay to this problem, which is that some of our costs are driven by where the benefit is, the venue of where the benefit is being provided? Right? I mean, sometimes a benefit's much more expensive, for example, if it's provided in a hospital-based clinic than some other kind of clinic. You know, I mean, like we have, I just think we need to be, I mean, by the way, I agree with what Dr. Chowdhury said also, but I do feel like that's sort of another driver here that we need to somehow control for.
And there are parts of that that I think, again, we're in scope and in purview of the group to deal with, and some that are not.
So yeah, I know. I'm the famous
steering committee, so lucky me.
Right. So where a service is delivered, who delivers it, how much they get paid for it, what the conditions are, is there prerequisites? I mean, these are all the variables.
It can be contained
in the recommendations from the group around a specific benefit as well, if the group feels that it's important to make those recommendations.
Yeah, that's where I think there needs to be a piece integrating the different, which always happens with work groups. I'm sure you guys have copious experience with this.
Yeah.
There needs to be an integration effort to pull it together, because a lot of things we've talked about, for instance, it's hard to discuss them outside of delivery system reform.
Right. And I agree with Elizabeth. There's access issues all over the place. I mean, you sometimes have to pay a lot more because you need to have access, and the population is there. I mean, there's places where it doesn't matter so much.
So I would say the integration is meant to happen at the MRT level. All the groups are making recommendations to the MRT. Some of them will conflict, count on it. Some of them will be aligned. Some of them will need further refinement. And some of them are pieces of something that need to be put together. So, I mean, again, I would rest assured that this is not, that these recommendations and you as a group are not operating in isolation. There's some mindfulness that this has to be integrated with those other work groups as well as whatever's on everyone's plate in October and November.
Maybe in the grid, what you could also do is figure out how to account for the expenditures that come from Article 31s, Article 16s. So you're kind of segregating the populations, because what we may find is that there needs to be a whole revamping of a delivery system, let's say in the old OMRDD section, and that's driving a lot of the costs. When you throw it all together, you're not able to identify that those costs actually belong to that population. So maybe in the grid that you do, you can kind of break it out on another table or some other way. So it gives us an idea of where are the expenditures actually coming from, what populations.
So I think some of that will be possible in the time frame that we have with the resources we have. It won't be possible for all the benefits. So I take that suggestion to be for those that we end up landing on. The degree that we think would be helpful to advance the conversation or to think about what the recommendation would be, that we would try to pursue that. But there's no way that we'll be able to do that for all this.
Foster, in terms of wins, to try to get something that we can win on with this, is it possible to get the top 10 low utilization, high cost, top 10 high cost, low utilization, the opposite? Answer high, low cost, high utilization, and then match that to some sort of appropriateness data, so that at the end of the day we're not ending up with just cost and counts. We're also ending up with some sort of appropriateness thing, so we can get to step three and say, okay, this is where we did it this way. Now we see we can build out a process forward with it.
I think we can try to do that. I think we would welcome the advice and expertise of the group to make recommendations of places we should look, particularly on the appropriateness side. I think we can do counts and amounts any day of the week, and we can slice it and we can dice it and so on. We've been doing that for a long time. It doesn't necessarily get us to what should we do and how should we do it. So whatever clinical and organizational experience you have that says, in our organization or from my point of view, these are some areas that you might want to look at, that would, I think, help guide us between now and the next time. We certainly have some suggestions already, and, Mark and other states and our own experience tells us some places to look. But
my thought would be is that if you could get us maybe, the top 20 or so counts and amounts, then that may trigger some thoughts as to where we look for appropriateness data and things like that, just, to get people focused in a direction, because we're too big and not focused.
Long-term care and disability services, does that work for you? That's where the top expenditures are. Am I overstating?
No, you're not. I mean, we could look at procedures and do top 20 lists on procedures. You're going to have to weed quite a way through because, when you get to those top 20 of high utilization, low cost, you got a lot of, real regular stuff that most people need that it's really hard to figure out if it's inappropriate. It's a little easier on the low utilization, high cost side. The my experience with looking at procedure lists, it's going to be much harder on the high utilization, low cost side. There's a lot of stuff there.
I think it might be helpful to circulate to folks, like, you know, Kaiser does the state-by-state, you know, breakdowns of what all the state Medicaid programs are spending on. I mean, maybe folks just aren't that familiar with that stuff. I mean, just because I think it would help. I think everybody sort of
says,
that's
a link, so that's easy.
Yeah, it's super easy, and we can just sort of see, okay, oh, my God, there's that home care thing. I mean, like, there's these.
So I'm gonna suggest I want to spend the next 10 minutes talking a little bit about process. So this is, this is a subset, but this is a much of what you got letters of support and information on that has been put to this committee, to you guys, to think about. And so I put it here, and one is missing is treatment for obesity as well, around which I think CMS just came out with some coverage for Medicare. And so we got of the ideas that we had submitted that, you know, we would think about how do we approach this? How do we, I'm bringing you into our challenge and making you part of the solution as well. So coverage of doulas. This is birth assistance. For those of you that don't know, the evidence-informed, I would say evidence-based YMCA diabetes prevention program, secondary prevention aimed at folks who have prediabetes or at risk of diabetes. Pharmacist reimbursement, we talked about, for tobacco cessation as well as dentists. The Nurse Family Partnership gets a big shout-out, lots of letters of support from the Nurse Family Partnership. Gender reassignment has been put on our list as well. Currently, we don't cover gender reassignment, and so that's been put on the list for us to consider. Expansion of counseling. Currently, we have some social work counseling. Should it be beyond social work? This kind of gets into your issue about the who and who we pay for and who we don't pay for. Breastfeeding consultants, as you'll see on the list of A and B rated preventive services, breastfeeding support is one of the things that is recommended. Breastfeeding consultants is a subset of breastfeeding support. Currently, Medicaid does not pay for lactation consultants, should it? It's come up several times and so on. And I mentioned the obesity one. I'm sure there will be more. And this list always continues and happens in every season, particularly in legislative season. But, you know, legislative season is a 12-month-a-year sport, somewhat like baseball now. So these are the kinds of benefits that as we think about going forward, either in terms of prioritizing for this group or in terms of a process for thinking about going forward, you know, this is sort of the nature of the challenge, is to think through this intelligently, to use, apply the principles and think about a process that's going to work. So I wasn't planning to go into great detail mostly because of time. I think we're going to need to work up some of these topics in the way that we've talked about in terms of the data and the evidence that we have for this group's conversation and consideration. But I just wanted to just reflect, since we spent some time talking about existing benefits, talking a little bit about overuse, I wanted to bring these up as well.
Can I just ask a point of clarification?
Yes.
I don't think I saw the gender reassignment proposal. Was it for hormones or for surgery or for both?
Both. Didn't come through the website.
Okay.
Right now, we pay, as you may know, we pay for social work counseling, we pay for psychiatrists, we pay for psychologists. We on the social work side, limit that to pregnant women and children under 19 years of age. Is it 21, Ron, or 19? 21 years of age. So we've had many proposals to rationalize that benefit and provide counseling to humans, not just pregnant humans and young humans. There's a lot of evidence around some of it. There's not much evidence around another large chunk of it. But we every year we get pleas to, particularly in Article 28, non-mental health and addiction facilities to cover counseling services under a broader scope of benefit.
LCSW
is the cover, yes. Well, the proposals have come in many forms, ranging from just take your current LCSW payment and expand it out to adults and men that are not pregnant. The the and it also has taken the form of going down the career ladder as far as, you know, covering peer counseling out of Article 28, doing outreach and engagement outside of the clinic and covering that with peers, which we've historically in the Article 28 medical world not paid for. OMH pays for a portion of what I said, not all of what I said. Yes.
Well, Greg, just in the terms of the framework, one of the things I heard Dr. Shah say as well in the very first meeting was that it's perfectly appropriate for the committee to also look at how we can make existing benefits work better. If there are opportunities, let's identify system redesign issues, you know, where we can make that benefit presumably more cost-effective, we should consider those as well. I bring it up in the context of the counseling issue because, as you know, this is the one area where I'll sort of become parochial. You know, the evidence for everything we do in behavioral health in terms of how we derive our treatments is, in fact, measurement-based. We know that. So all the studies about how we do counseling, medications, what kinds of improvements to expect, we do all that based on measurement. But in the clinical reality of our world for behavioral health, very few people actually measure what they're doing. So one of the things I would just put on the table for the committee to consider at a future date is, in fact, to take on any of these issues. But as it relates to behavioral health, even though we're not in that committee, it's to me something that other states are looking at where measurement goes with treatment, particularly with certain very prominent conditions like depression and the like. So I just wanted to put that on the table.
It's a good one. I think the other one that's not on the list but got frequently mentioned was screening and brief intervention strategies that I think you could somewhat lump them under the counseling rubric here, but we've had those suggestions as well, particularly given the evidence around some of it for some populations.
So I guess one of the questions is, in order for us to evaluate them, we're going to have to also understand the budget impact, right? So you guys would have to model out more or less what budget impact each of those things would have.
Yes, and I've been thinking a little about that between meetings, too. Some of this is very difficult to put an actual dollar sign on, particularly between the next two meetings. One of the thoughts, and I've not had a chance yet to even talk to my colleagues internally, is that we could come up with a rating system, you know, $1 sign for low cost, $4 signs for high cost, both for our savings and for our spending. Try basically to be balancing out the $1 and $2 sign cost proposals with a $1 and $2 sign spend proposal, something that would not require us to get down to, you know, counting pennies in the group, but be thinking about relative scope and magnitude. And that's something we'll, you know, kick around internally. I throw it out for people to think about as a framework for, you know, reaction at the next meeting.
Greg, another way of thinking about it is all of those are prevention pieces, right? So what would be the cost of not doing it? So if you didn't fund the nurse family partnership, then what could that possibly end up with? And what's the cost to the state now?
Yeah, part of that, it's a very fair question. Part of it is how do we count cost neutrality when we're banking against future savings that would potentially accrue in an out year? And I think the one thing I know about the global cap is it's cash-based. I think what we'd have to be doing is on a cash basis to be assuring the financial plan that whatever we added as expenditure for the coming fiscal year, we would be subtracting an expenditure for the coming fiscal year. Potentially, as things grow, we could count out your savings, but they would need to be self-sufficient in the year in which they were implemented. So that's somewhat of a challenge with things like prevention that may, like a nurse family partnership, that may produce savings that are not immediate to the year in which they're implemented.
Greg, are things such as long-term care and disability benefits, which I think are about 30% of the total Medicaid costs in New York State.
And growing.
Is there opportunity to look at those benefits? Because I think what we're looking at here, a large volume, you may save a dollar here, $1.50 there, where And I think that structure is not just the benefits, it's the whole fair hearing and external appeal process. And
yeah.
Part of the benefit can mean, well, you make a benefit decision, that's the benefit decision. There aren't the advocacy rights to go back and change
eight hours
to 12 hours to 16 hours. And
yeah, absolutely.
And those, are those on the table for this committee or not?
We our hope was that they would not be in scope because we have several vehicles that we're collecting thoughts and input on, and as you know, we had a lot of activity in non-institutional long-term care in particular as part of MRT round one. So we were really trying to focus this group on the structure of the basic benefit outside of pharmacy, outside of long-term care, outside of mental hygiene, where there are some other specific focuses. That being said, if there's ideas that come from this group, we certainly can forward them on to the appropriate group or to the mothership for consideration.
We shouldn't miss, I know there's a desire to get at what's the single root or what's the biggest bang for the buck or whatever, and I resonate with that, but I would also like to underscore that building a process by which things are evaluated is a step forward from where we are in a systematic way. The second is cutting anything intelligently, I would offer, is like new learning for us. Not that we've never done it, but it is extremely hard to take anything away. So I wouldn't underestimate the value of even creating a process and a consensus and a model to think about something, even if the dollar value did not, you know, make everybody go, wow, because there is part of what we need to do is to learn how to do this, not just for Medicaid. Medicare, commercial, we are all in this conundrum where we are having an affordability problem. And, again, Plan B is just cuts in eligibility, cuts in optional services, cuts in budget, cuts in payments to providers. Plan B may still happen, but what we're trying to do is come up with Plan A, which is to be more strategic about it. So I don't get too distracted by having to find the thing that's going to make it all happen, because there isn't. I mean, as much as we have to learn, if there was one thing, we would have done it by now. It's a lot of things. And the reality is that, you know, how do you get to spend $52 billion in the Medicaid program? Benefit by benefit by benefit by benefit. And so, that's how you get to do it. We do it on volume, yes, but we do it on benefit. So this is not a one-time issue. This is sort of a long-term issue.
I actually totally agree with you, but do you think we have an adequate understanding of why your current sort of medical benefit review process isn't working in order to be helpful enough? I mean, the answer may be yes, and that's fine.
I think what we tried to queue up is that we have some benefits that we think have high value, that is actually even have savings associated with them, like tobacco cessation. I didn't go into the detail around that. But that's underused. Can I explain to you why it's underused? No, but I offer it as an issue around benefits.
I guess that wasn't quite.
Okay,
I'm not sure. If we're,
process.
Yeah, I mean, I know we have an. You in your first presentation last time, you said there's this existing process. You have your three directors. You can't deal with all the CPT codes.
Right.
There's some staffing problems.
I was about to get to what.
Right.
The
I mean,
process.
I was just thinking. Like, I think for us, it would be helpful to be helpful to you. I agree. I'm on board with, like, designing a process. I think that makes total sense.
Right.
And so, but for us to be helpful in, I think, helping you design a process, it would be helpful to understand why what you've currently got isn't working, because I always sort of thought you guys had a process for making some of these decisions, certainly on the Medicaid managed care side.
It's not that we have no process. We have a process. We have a process that we're looking to improve.
Yeah.
So we're running out of time, so let me just, I'll tee this up. And you'll get, because I don't think we sent it in all the packets, because I wanted to have more conversation than just put the draft out, but I think we'll put the draft out, some notion about this process for benefit review. This process is really, what I'm talking about in here is not so much between now and the end of October for this group, although they have some parallels, but really about putting forward a draft of an idea of what the process would look like and how it could become a stronger and a better process. And include some of the things we talked about today and other ideas. So let me just go through a few of the main points of it. Again, you'll get the document, and this is hopefully one of those things like the principles
that we can do some work together as a group with through email between now and the next meeting and have something that's less drafty that more folks have had a chance to weigh in on. But the process as we're envisioning it is that going forward is that there is both an internal group and an external group. That is, there's an internal group of folks, clinicians within our office that would review evidence, that would use whatever principles and guidelines or prioritization or scheme of rating evidence or all the other things we talked about today to look at and evaluate various new services, including new CPT codes, HCPCS codes, requests from providers, from the industry, from anyone that would mandate review, and come out with various recommendations that could range from no coverage to limited coverage, including any of the various tools of limiting coverage, to, you know, deferred due to insufficient information, and perhaps there's some other choice points. That those decisions that would be made by clinicians around the clinical evidence would then be forwarded to finance folks who would look at it for its impact on financial, what the financial impact would be, trying to take into consideration, as was said earlier, intended, unintended consequences. Does doing it in this fashion, does it mean that we wouldn't pay for this? Would it be additive? Would it be subtractive? What are the, you know, is there literature to help us predict what some of the unintended consequences would be, because after all, sometimes you know, and it's okay. It's not that big a deal, but you know what they are. Those decisions would be separately reviewed by finance for what's the financial impact. And then the notion would be that and any information that the clinicians had to help the finance folks make that decision would be forwarded. And then final determinations would be made by a combination of this group that looked at both clinical effectiveness as well as costs and cost effectiveness in those reviews. Any impact that any decision that was over X amount of dollars, and that's a, you know, who knows what that dollar amount should be in the draft that you'll see, I put $1 million would go to our boss above our pay grade, let him or her in the future make some decision about that. But essentially there would be some threshold by which there might be a different process of review. The final determinations and the process used and the folks who made it and the evidence they based it on and what the grade of that evidence would all be publicly available and publicly, you know, on a website and so on, so people could understand, like there is for other insurers but not so much for us. You know, here's what Medicaid covers, here's why it covered it, here's when it was reviewed, here's the evidence that we used, and this was our evaluation of that evidence in making the coverage decisions. In addition, there'd be an external group that would meet, that would not be able to, you know, that would be composed in such a way and that would need sort of to do some of what we're trying to do here, which is folks out of the department, kind of a 10,000-foot view of what's happening in terms of the benefit actually. It would also be a group that would help us with particularly sticky wickets and particularly controversial areas, would bring in expert folks as well. But it's really as a mechanism, perhaps a balance, but perhaps it's just an additional resource to be able to either look at decisions that were made in the previous quarter or half year or whatever that determination would be, seek assistance in areas that were particularly problematic, and also sort of help in terms of guidance and thinking about the entire package, which may include looking at costs and amounts, where are we outliers, where do we have benefits, but what we're seeing is that there isn't much uptake. Is it a payment issue? Is it a plan issue? Is it a where it's delivered issue? Is it a it's too restrictive in terms of who can deliver it and so on and so forth? And that, you know, at very high level, there's a little bit more detail, but not very much in this draft that you'll see, is sort of a proposal to the group to think about and chew on as a process for going forward post-November to recommend to MRT and to the state. There's clearly a lot of other, a lot of other detail that could be put in this about, you know, who and how it should it be composed and is it consensus and so on. But I wanted to get our conversation going. This is, again, one of the things that I think would be very useful, and it's a specific charge to the group, is to come up with some recommendations to MRT about a process going forward. It builds on something that we started to put together. So as you rightly say, it's not that we have nothing. But the challenges of doing what I just described, the internal part, clearly resources are a challenge. We had folks who were dedicated to doing it, and they left, and then they came back. The evidence, as Mark, you know, talked about, and we all talked about today, you know, the challenges of really using the evidence and the need to often deal in the gray areas, as Dr. Chaudhry mentioned, or to apply judgment to evidence, because the evidence only gets you so far. Cost-effectiveness analysis, I think we'd be the first to admit, I think our ability to do cost-effective analyses effectively, this is not a business we've been in. We would need to rely on others or some process of thinking about this that may be crude initially. There are volume issues. I mean, the number of potential benefits, the number of new procedures, the new CPT codes, HCPCS codes that come along that we need to review. I was on a conference call about the last batch. I mean, it's like hundreds of things, that some of which even I can barely pronounce, let alone understand what the heck it is. That challenges the system, and that's part of why even if you had a rigorous external group, there's no way you could have that group meet and make all the minutia of those decisions all the time. And then, as was mentioned earlier, the role of the health plans and how to, because a lot of the, both the decision-making, the impact, and the implementation, particularly on the area of, I'll just call it utilization review or limitation or appropriateness criteria and so on, is really within the plan's purview. And so the question of how much uniformity should there be, do we allow plans to do things differently, do we back you up? Do we run away and hide? You know, all of those issues, I think, come into play. So I apologize that we ran out of time. This is really an important issue and an important deliverable for this group. I hope you'll look at what we send on this and give it some thought and feel free to mark it up and comment on it. And we'll have a more rigorous conversation about it next time. Hopefully we'll be able to have some sort of rough consensus that we can go through in the agenda of the next meeting. So should we talk a little bit about next meeting? Or
Sure.
Do you want to?
No. So we'll have a next meeting. I think what would probably be good product-wise for the next meeting is we'll have circulated a revised draft from the feedback that we got today, sort of on our principles. We'll get a starter set for this matrix of sort of the pluses and minuses that we talked about, with hopefully some data, whatever we have, to be able to consider them. We have a long list of other things you asked for that both Foster and I wrote down, and we'll get back, and I saw Ron writing in the back. We'll get those things back between meetings as well. And then as Foster mentioned, we've started a draft process document. We could get that out. Would appreciate feedback between meetings. Hopefully we could get a discussion going in the next meeting to get that one to final. So I think in the end we're going to probably have three products. One would be the set of finalized principles. The second would be a draft process for ongoing review of new ads and subtracts as they come in, or a framework to review the existing benefit against. And then the third, probably our hardest thing, would be a set of specific recommendations for benefit redesign that would include some tweaks to existing things we cover and maybe a couple of ads that were accommodated within those reductions that we were able to achieve on any benefit reduction that we did. And I think probably what we want to be able to do is to have more of a conversation on the second and third deliverable. Hopefully we can quickly put the principles document behind us, maybe even between meetings, and just kind of kissing off at the beginning of the next meeting, and then really focus the meat of the next meeting on the process document and on those specific deliverables. I mean, does that sound a reasonable way to proceed? Okay.
October 4th, that's the next meeting.
Sounds right.
October 4th, 10:30 to 3 in Troy.
Troy. Not underwater anymore, so you can actually go to Troy.
So let me just, in terms of the recommendations, I think that the template that Greg just mentioned is really what we're going to try to follow. But remember that this group can also make more general recommendations. What do I mean? So we talked a lot about the who and the where of delivery of certain services. I mean, the group can make a general recommendation to say that in areas of high-value services where there is documented underuse, the state should consider, you know, expanding any limitations it may have on place or on person that delivers services, and maybe make specific recommendations around that. Henry, if I heard your comment right about measurement and delivery of services, you know, we can say, you know, certain services need to be delivered along with measurement, that we have a whole area in which treatments are delivered without corresponding evaluation of progress. And that's I mean, it's a benefit issue. Maybe it's a quality payment issue. I don't know. But again, I think the group can consider things that may be as generic as that or maybe apply to a specific set of benefits. To me, that fits under this rubric of trying to improve the value of the benefits that we have.
Or recommend an investigation of.
Right. Or look into it. So I appreciate how big this topic is and its overlap with a lot of the other work groups. You know, Trusta will try to sort out some of that overlap and some of that connection as time goes on. Gene,
just in terms of new benefit ideas, is the expectation that we're going to have some sort of opinion on each of these things?
I think the expectation is that we need to come up with a framework by which we as a group and we, Medicaid and state, can evaluate these things going forward. So I would say yes, and these are probably as good as any to sort of put through whatever rubric we have.
So as soon as you can, in addition to the letters of support and the
evidence,
you know, the data that you have, once it gets into some sort of cohesive fashion,
right,
punch that out as
right
soon as possible. So that gives
right
better thought.
Now, Mark mentioned something which we'll bring to the group as well, which is this dossier thing that Washington State is doing. I've forgotten about that. It's a really interesting idea, which is basically what Washington did is throw the onus back on folks who want coverage of new things and say, we're willing to consider it. Here's the information you have to supply to us. We will review it. We will supplement it. We will make sure you're not lying, cheating, stealing in the data that you have. But, you know, we want you to fill in the blanks about this.
Can you send a link around to that?
And I can send out the template for that. I've not looked at it in a while.
I've heard
Jeff present it.
I think we should look at that. Yeah.
Right.
Or maybe if it's not too huge, even have it at the next.
Right.
It also squares up very nicely with your principle about who duty it is to advocate for coverage.
Correct. Dr. Shaw, are you still on the phone?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Wow.
I just want to thank everyone for their active participation. First and foremost, Dr. and Greg for serving as co-chairs for this meeting. And then certainly Mark and Scott for working on the principles and other things between these two meetings. We don't have many meetings left, so I am hoping that all of you can keep actively engaged by email, electronically, phone calls, whatever, between the meetings with Foster and Greg so that we can get the maximum bang for our buck with this committee and really get all of your valuable input, whether it's proposals, ideas you want to bounce off, anything. Feel free to call us anytime. Except for Saturdays and Sundays, and we'll definitely get back to and share with the group. So I'll see you guys in Troy. That's it for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And next meeting you'll have the real co-chairs here. Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.